Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall-Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
And we're so glad you can join us. I don't know how many of our Brussels Sprouts listeners realize, but May 7th was a significant and pretty overlooked anniversary. For those of you who aren't tracking, it was the 20th anniversary of President Putin's inauguration. And so a pretty important milestone in Russian history. He's now the longest serving Russian leader since Stalin. And I'm sure he hopes that he will have many more inaugurations to come. We know he's in the process of trying to extend his term limits and reset his clock to stay on longer. But we wanted to take a moment just to kind of mark the anniversary by thinking and reflecting on how Putin has changed Russia and Russia's place in the world over the last 20 years. And so to do that, we've got a great guest joining us today. We're joined by Mike Carpenter. Mike, welcome.
Thanks.
Great. For those of you who don't know Mike, Mike is the managing director at the Penn Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement. He's also a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. And he has spent a number of years in the U.S. government, including as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, looking at Russia, Eurasia, Ukraine, Balkans, and conventional arms control. He spent time in the White House as Foreign Policy Advisor to Vice President Biden, as well as serving as the National Security Council Director for Russia. So we have a wealth of knowledge to tap into as we think about some of these big, broad questions. But Mike, maybe we can just start with that very biggest question and think about and hear your views on kind of as you think about Putin in power for the last 20 years, you know, how has he changed Russia and Russia's place in the world?
So thanks, Andrea. The way I see Putin's 20 years in power is as a gradual series of constrictions on democracy. The first 6-7 years, more or less, were an attempt by Putin to consolidate power in Russia. And he inherited a Russian state that was dominated by centrifugal forces. You had governors and regions like the Russian Far East who had their own customs and taxation systems that they applied without any regard for what was the mandate of the central government. And so Putin reined all of this in and created a centralized state. And at the same time, he started to consolidate power and attack sort of the democratic institutions that had emerged in Russia in the 1990s. So, for example, independent media were corralled and brought under control. The oligarchs were tamed and made subservient to Putin through a number of quasi-legal maneuvers. But then, you know, Putin pivoted around 2007, 2008. There's no real exact point in time where you can say that he flipped a switch, but he began to exert much more influence over the countries on his periphery. So it went from internal subversion of democracy to subverting democracy on Russia's periphery and seeking to sort of reestablish a patronage system that allowed the Kremlin to control politics in the Russian near abroad. And so here, the seminal events were the cyber attack on Estonia in 2007, invasion of Georgia in 2008, and then the invasion of Ukraine in 2014. And that leads us to what I view as the third phase in the Putin power period, the last two decades, which is a period where his attack on democratic institutions and norms has expanded from Russia and the immediate Russian periphery to essentially the whole democratic world. Obviously, there's the interference in our election in 2016, but far beyond that, there's dark money schemes in Western Europe, attempts to subvert democracy really all over the world, the intervention in Syria and so on and so forth. So I see this as three phases: attacking democracy in Russia, attacking democracy on Russia's periphery, and then attacking democracy worldwide.
I think one of the big debates you hear in the Russia community is kind of what drives Putin's motivations and when he's willing to act most aggressively internationally. So you have one camp on the one hand that will say, well, Putin really is only willing to take his riskiest, most aggressive actions when he's defending Russian interests, when he's trying to avoid this geopolitical loss. And then others in another camp who will say, no, it's much more about Putin who, you know, given the personalization of power that you've talked about, is really able to kind of proactively exploit opportunities as he sees them and has much more revisionist aims. And so where would you kind of put yourself on, you know, on that spectrum, and how do you think about that issue? What drives some of these actions that have been perceived so aggressively and are so aggressive, but from the West perspective?
Yeah, so I see two sides to Putin's governing personality. On the one hand, he very much models himself as a gospodarstvennik, someone who is in charge of the state and has the best interests of the state in mind and will pursue those interests fiercely and without regard to any of Russia's neighbors or any other states in the international community to essentially strengthen Russia to make it into a great power. But then the other side of Putin's governing personality is the side that we've seen ever since the early 1990s, when Putin was working in St. Petersburg for then Mayor Anatoly Sobchak, where he dealt with sort of this nebulous sphere of organized crime groups and emerging oligarchs and businessmen in this sort of lawless period where the Soviet Union was coming apart, and where he presided over essentially what you know, can be called a patronage system, a system where, you know, various actors were empowered to do whatever they wanted to do to amass wealth and power, but as long as they paid tribute to the authorities that were subservient or over them, superseded them. And so these two aspects of Putin's personality, the sort of the rational state administrator and the corrupt, kleptocratic chieftain of these neo-feudal sort of fiefdoms within Russia coexist. And they determine how Putin acts on any number of occasions. But you have to always bear in mind that both sides of his personality are operative at any given moment.
Talked about 2014 as kind of a pivotal moment, which I agree. It's, I think, where you see Putin really going on the offensive, much more in, you know, a flip in frame where he's not just kind of trying to push back against the democracy promotion, but where he's taking the fight to the democracies themselves. And so how much of that do you think is because of a lackluster response from the West in 2008, in 2014? I mean, do you get the sense that there was some lessons learned for Putin, that he learned what he might be able to get away with? Or how do you kind of explain why that flip switched and why we see a much more assertive, aggressive Russia post-2014?
I think there's absolutely no doubt that Putin learned the lesson from 2008 that he can act with relative impunity in the states along his periphery that aren't NATO members. So that excludes the Baltic countries and can do what he wants militarily to achieve his aims. Now, he realizes, of course, there are certain limits to this. Mass casualties, mass atrocities would be probably a red line that he would approach very cautiously and reluctantly cross. But absolutely, the fact that there were no sanctions in 2008 after the invasion of Georgia, that really the economic consequences of that invasion were sharp in terms of the downturn in global markets, but were easily overcome within the matter of a few years, I think convinced both Putin and also his inner entourage in the Kremlin that this was a viable strategy for reasserting control over a satellite state that had gone over to the Western side. And clearly he sees it as his mission to prevent what he views as the satellite states on Russia's periphery from becoming integrated into Euro-Atlantic institutions. But one more thing I want to say, you know, I don't like the debate in the Russia Watcher community between those who posit that Putin is primarily defensive in nature and those who posit that he is offensive. I think Putin concluded a long time ago that the best defense is sometimes a good offense, and he's certainly shown that over the course of the last 5, 7, 8 years. I think they're one in the same, really.
Let me jump in here just for a second and say hello to you, Mike. Great colleague of mine. We served together in the Pentagon, a fellow DASD, and when you appeared around the staff meeting table in Alyssa's office, you were a great addition to our discussion. So it's good to see you on Brussels Sprouts as well. I have a question in terms of let's take Putin back a little bit, and when he first entered office, what his view was then of the United States. I say that because, you know, you were just talking about the various schools of thought out there about Putin. But there's also one that I hear quite a bit about how the West, and particularly the United States, helped to shape Putin to be feeling threatened by NATO, threatened by the West. NATO enlargement had caused him to fear that he was going to be encircled. And of course, that narrative from Moscow of being encircled by NATO, broken promises, kind of started with Putin. The Putin that started after Yeltsin had left and Putin shows up, had he already been shaped by things that the U.S. did or didn't do, or NATO and enlargement, this type of thing? Or did he arrive in office pretty much with that Cold War mindset that he was already oriented towards an anti-West view, and it wasn't like we did anything in the 90s to get him there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, Jim, I think both of those are to a certain degree caricatures. I think Putin's fundamental orientation towards geopolitics was shaped back in the Soviet days when he served in the KGB, and his idol was Yuri Andropov, the Soviet leader and longtime KGB chairman who presided over the quashing of the revolution in Budapest in 1956, and was really a hardliner within the KGB. That was Putin's idol. That's who he aspired to be. And so his anti-Western orientation, his view of the United States as Russia's number one adversary, if not enemy, was shaped early on in his life and certainly has continued on through to the present day. I do think that when he came to power first as prime minister in 99 and then as president in 2000, I think he probably thought then that he needed to get along with the West because Russia depended so heavily on Western investment above all in order to succeed economically. And there really was no real thinking at that time that Russia could form a condominium with China. In fact, over 95% of the foreign direct investment stock in Russia around 2000 was from either Western Europe, the United States, Japan, or Canada, so Western countries. And he thought there was no alternative to that. And so that shaped his mindset in the early years. A lot of people cite, for example, his call to George W. Bush after 9/11, offering to help the United States in fighting terror. And I think he very much wanted to ingratiate himself with Bush and wanted to pursue some sort of cooperative agenda because he saw it as being in Russia's interest. But did he at the same time view the U.S. as his chief adversary? Probably yes. Yes, there have been evolutions in Putin's thinking, but let's not fool ourselves that he ever thought that the West was Russia's geostrategic friend.
If we maybe stick along these lines with U.S.-Russia relations and fast forward to the present, I think another debate probably within the Russia-watching community is how President Putin looks at President Trump and kind of in the 2016 election. When Putin sits back, you know, in his office alone and maybe does a little after action report in a stock taking exercise of whether or not his intervention in the 2016 election was a net benefit or a net cost to Russia. What do you, I mean, obviously nobody can possibly know this, but what do you think President Putin thinks? Do you think he looks back at that and is happy that he kind of put his finger on the scale and weighed in on behalf of President Trump? Has Trump delivered anything that he was hoping for? What do you think?
I think he probably does a fist bump every day, thanking his lucky stars that he managed to get away with the sort of interference that he did in 2016 and that Trump is the president of the United States. This has been a gift that keeps on giving for Putin ever since Inauguration Day in 2017. And, you know, some of the president's supporters will say, well, but didn't President Trump provide Javelin missiles to Ukraine? Didn't he take some strikes in Syria? But look, for Putin, the sum total of these last 3.5 years is phenomenal chaos in the United States, polarization, and a weakening of U.S. democratic institutions. That was first and foremost his aim in empowering a anti-establishment alternative in the 2016 election. And remember that he was willing to promote them on both the right and the left. There's evidence that the Russians were also, in terms of their social media trolls and bots, supporting the Sanders candidacy to a certain extent. So for Putin, this is the case in almost all countries that have democratic institutions, that the Russians will go in and support both the far left and the far right alternatives to the establishment in order precisely to try to undermine and weaken democratic institutions and also supranational institutions like NATO and the EU. And so, yeah, Putin must be delighted with what he's seeing play out today, you know, with even things that have nothing to do with geopolitics. When, when Trump gets out there and advises his supporters that, you know, maybe ingesting bleach is a way to deal with coronavirus, this is music to Putin's ears. This is the sort of nationalist populist nonsense that is bringing America down and that he celebrates.
And looking forward.
And by the way, on that last point, Andrea, sorry to interrupt you, but Russia has been actively promoting the anti-vaxxer movement, not just in the U.S., but in Italy, Spain, other places. And so this fits perfectly, this example that I cited, with what Putin is trying to achieve.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. I also think, net benefit for Putin. He looks back and is probably, incredibly happy with what this has produced. So what are you most worried about in the run-up to the election this fall? I mean, again, I think the stakes are incredibly high. The difference between Vice President Biden and President Trump are huge. And when we think about kind of coming out of this post-COVID environment, it's hard to think of a positive scenario for the United States if President Trump is at the helm. We know Putin dislikes Vice President Biden just about, if not more, than he did Secretary Clinton. And so the stakes, again, I think are really high. The margin of votes between Biden and Trump are still pretty slim. So perhaps there's a view from the Kremlin that they can put their thumb on the scale and tip the outcome in one direction or another. So what are you most worried about in the run-up to this coming election?
Look, I think I'm worried about this election like no other election that we've ever had in our history, including 2016, because the pandemic will be with us. There is no way that we will be out of this crisis in November. Even if there's partial easing over the summer months, the virus will still be there, and there will be subsequent waves, and there'll be subsequent lockdowns. I think we can count on that, and that's an environment that's just rife for any type of foreign interference, not just Russian, but other powers as well. But certainly the Kremlin is going to be interested in trying to promote the Trump candidacy. And my feeling is that they are going to double down on support for organic forms of disinformation that emerge in the U.S. In 2016, you had the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg paying their trolls to, spread messages and with bad English grammar, promoting all kinds of weird ideas and stoking divisions along different lines. But I think this time around, all Russia has to do is look for those weaknesses within our own system. Look at, for example, Alex Jones's InfoWars site and make financial contributions to it or amplify it on various social media accounts. and sort of rely on the U.S.'s own cleavages and disinformation to attack our system.
Then in thinking about kind of U.S.-Russia relations moving forward, it's hard to imagine a situation where we see any real improvement. The confrontation and the kind of hostility between the United States and Russia seems like it will persist for quite some time. Do you share that view, or kind of what do you, when you think about U.S.-Russia relations, do you see any opportunities where we could improve things? Are there some areas where you think progress can be made? And I guess I'll push you a little bit to talking about the arms control issue, which I think has become the real cornerstone of the relationship for the time being, with New START kind of ready to expire in February of next year. Do you think that the future really is about arms control? And so what do you think are the prospects of extending that treaty? And if that's not the bright spot, are there potential others where there can be at least some coordination and cooperation between the two sides?
Well, a great question. I think there's no doubt that the U.S. and Russia are going to be in a period of strategic rivalry for the foreseeable future. So I don't think that there's going to be any kind of reset under any future administrations in the near term. This is competition short of conflict that we're in right now. And as many of my friends who serve in the intelligence community like to say, we're already at war with Russia right now, today. It's not a kinetic military war, but it's a war that's being waged through active measures, through covert financing, through cyber operations, through disinformation, and various other means aimed at weakening the opposing side. And so, you know, things are not going to become rosy under any future administration. They're going to continue to be very fraught. You know, in terms of arms control, there is an obvious opportunity to extend the New START Treaty, which expires on February 5th of next year. And that would provide a little bit of ballast in the relationship and would potentially provide an avenue for then building on that to do more arms control, certainly to revive discussions on stability, which I think are long overdue. But I wouldn't say that either the extension of the New START Treaty or any other arms control talks that get launched next year, should there be an opportunity to do so, would change the fundamental tenor of the U.S.-Russia relationship. As I said, I think that relationship remains one of competition short of conflict, great power competition, if you like, for the foreseeable future.
How is Putin doing in Europe? Let's change the focus a bit from Washington and the elections and all the domestic stuff here, and look at how he's doing with his European counterparts. I find that's usually really interesting, is European politics among themselves. And so how are the capitals looking on Putin now? I mean, you've got the various energy negotiations and deals being made out of Berlin, the Nord Stream being the primary one. How is he doing there? Is that a separate line of effort that he's making there? He's got a very different context as he deals with European capitals, with European counterparts. The Italians have a special relationship with him, it seems. He's been delivering masks to various European capitals. What's happening among the Europeans with Putin?
Well, you know, it's been, we've been in a period now since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, where Europe is united on a sort of minimal floor of sanctions that are imposed on Russia, but there is no consensus on increasing those sanctions. And in fact, if you look at various European capitals, you find a lot of dissensus in terms of how to deal with Russia and how to cope with Putin. That's been the case, really. You know, there was a momentary cohesion after MH17 was shot down, where there was this, you know, palpable outrage across all of Europe and a desire to sanction Russia more strongly for its actions. But really, you know, since that dissipated only a few months after the incident itself, we've been living with a very divided Europe. And so right now you have leaders like Angela Merkel, who, yes, you know, she supports the Nord Stream 2 pipeline which is very damaging to Ukraine's energy security. But at the same time, she's been one of the driving forces for imposing costs on Russia and for dealing with Putin from a sort of containment perspective. On the other hand, you've got the leaders of Italy, who you alluded to, Jim, the Five-Star Movement, which is very receptive to cooperation with Putin's Russia, the Lega Party, which is no longer in government, but was fairly recently. You know, the Lega Party has a memorandum of understanding with Putin's United Russia Party, and there's been some speculation that they may have been trying to seek Russian funding years ago. In fact, there were some tapes from Moscow that were brought into the public light that showed there were discussions ongoing about diverting energy profits to support the party. So there's cozy relationships in Italy. Now you have President Macron, whose own campaign was right. interfered in by the Kremlin in order to try to knock it down in favor of Marine Le Pen, has come around to this view that France has to have a special relationship with Russia and there needs to be a rapprochement. Now, this is seen with absolute horror by the states on the eastern side of the continent, by the Baltic states, by Poland, Czech Republic, although not the Czech president. So you have countries that are divided internally too. For Czech Republic, you got a president who's very pro-Putin, extremely so. And then you have other politicians who are much more skeptical of Putin. So it's a continent divided, really.
One of the rationale that I think Macron will give for why there needs to be kind of a warmer approach to Russia is because he's concerned by the deepening ties between Russia and China. And so his view, and as is the view of some others, is that the United States and Europe, but mostly the United States, taking a hardline approach, particularly against Russia, but also this dual hardline approach against Russia and China concurrently, is what's really driving them together and deepening their ties and increasing their alignment and coordination in ways that then would be quite problematic for the West. How concerned are you by this kind of growing alignment between Russia and China? Is it something that you're thinking about? Or something that you view kind of as more temporary, just a temporary marriage of convenience that will move on, you know, as soon as they disagree in a key region like Central Asia? I guess the question is, how concerned are you by this increasing alignment that we're seeing between these two actors?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. And I think there is a real strategic threat from the alignment or rapprochement between Russia and China. And it's something that we should fear. They are driven together not just by a marriage of convenience. They have a fundamental strategic interest in weakening Western democracies because they see them as a threat to their oligarchic authoritarian systems. In fact, I see this as the sort of the overriding narrative of 21st century geopolitics. It's a really becoming a bipolar world, whether we recognize it or not, with liberal democracies on the one hand struggling against oligarchic authoritarian states on the other. So I think that the Russia-Chinese relationship is going to continue to grow in the years to come. Eventually, there will come a time where some of the inherent tensions between Russia and China will prevent the two countries from really taking this relationship above a certain level. And you just have to look, for example, at the demographics of the Russian Far East, which is very sparsely populated, as compared with the demographics of northern China, which is very densely populated. And you understand that this poses a real economic threat to the viability of the Russian state long term. But those are long term considerations. And, you know, Putin doesn't really think in terms of long term calculus. He seems to be focused mostly on the sort of the 3-5 year time horizon. And this, what I'm talking about in terms of tensions between Russia and China, really doesn't play out until 10, 15, 20, 30 years from now. So I think that the alliance, if you will, between Russia and China is here to stay in the medium term. And I think it's actually a fool's errand for the US to try to divide the two countries, because they do have this common interest in countering what they consider to be color revolutions, Western-inspired movements like the Hong Kong pro-democracy protests or the pro-democracy protests in Russia in the winter of 2011-2012. And that's going to keep them united. And this sort of Steve Bannon-esque type view that you can align with Russia to counter China is only going to fail and get you nothing from the Russians other than, you know, frankly, a stab in the back. And it won't serve to sort of decouple the two powers, in my view.
We're getting close to the end. I don't know, Jim, if you have other questions, but maybe I can throw kind of one out there at the end, just thinking of maybe how we could be surprised. I think the one thing we haven't really mentioned too much is the COVID crisis and how that's impacting Putin. It's certainly, you know, making life quite a bit more difficult for him. It came at a really difficult time as he's working to restart his term limits, an incredibly vulnerable time for any authoritarian regime. So kind of putting on my icy hat for a minute, how could we be surprised either domestically by potential instability inside Russia, or can you imagine dynamics created by COVID that Putin could look to exploit or take advantage of in some ways? What are you worried about? How might we be surprised?
If I could jump on that question as well, what's one that's very similar, which is, you know, we're always being asked, so what do you guys think the impact on NATO is going to be, the impact on the allies are going to be in terms of their military capability, looking at defense, looking at, defense budgets and defense spending and this type of thing. And of course, a lot of that depends on what's going to happen with the Russians. So the, you know, the question that I have is, along the same lines as Andrea, what's the impact on terms of defense security with the Russians as well coming out of COVID? Is this something that's actually going to have to be in part of the calculations among defense planners at NATO or in the allied capitals, that they're going to be dealing with a Russia and a Russian defense capability that's different than what it would have looked like a couple of months ago?
So I think Russia is entering a period of enormous instability. And I'm not an analyst who in the past has ever, you know, blithely said that I see that Putin's reign is coming to an end because his popularity is about to plummet. I think Putin has a very firm grip on power. But we're entering a period with a lot of variables in flux. And Putin has shown just over the last 2 months that he's made two fundamental tactical mistakes. And he's normally, you know, people say, and I think it's a cliche, but it's largely true that Putin is tactically brilliant and strategically sometimes a little short-sighted. But he's made two tactical mistakes recently, and that's unusual. The first was when the Saudis asked the Russians to agree to OPEC plus production cuts to prop up the price of oil. And Putin decided to go for an oil glut, calculating that he could wipe out U.S. independent shale producers, and instead scored this massive own goal on his own production, because he hadn't quite kept up to speed on what was happening with the U.S. shale industry and its consolidation. The fact that you can actually turn off a lot of production in various wells in the U.S. and be quite okay. Instead, the hit to the Russians was very steep, and he had to, you know, he faced a humiliating prospect of a climb down when he agreed to those cuts as they were brokered by President Trump. That was mistake number one. Mistake number two was projecting this aura of invincibility surrounding COVID when the pandemic was bearing down across Russia. For many months, there was only one lab in all of Russia that was doing testing on COVID in Novosibirsk. And the authorities had no clue how widespread this was, but they were still very adamant about projecting this aura of strength. And now you have these video clips on YouTube and other Russian social media sites showing ambulances lined up for miles, sometimes drivers taking patients 150 kilometers just to find an open hospital bed. And so this is really ravishing Putin's popularity. He's down to historic lows now. And I'm not predicting that, you know, there's going to be some revolution from below. I don't think so. But I think we have to watch the situation very carefully, because on the one hand, this could lead to foreign adventurism, which is a tried and true Kremlin strategy for dealing with the potential for unrest at home. And second, you know, this is now an era of huge uncertainty, and we don't know how this will play out. We've seen protests in places that don't normally have protests. Rostov, Vladikavkaz, cities like that, not Moscow and St. Petersburg. So there's a lot going on here. And of course, Putin wants to extend his power till 2036. So let's watch closely. This is going to be a very bumpy ride.
Yeah, I agree. I would, you know, just... Yeah. also agree with you. Putin has a firm grip on power, but I would say that grip is less secure than it was just 6 months ago. So I think there's lots of interesting to watch. There's also things that could emerge. You know, what happens? Lukashenko is handling this poorly in Belarus. What happens if there's a big uprising in Belarus? How does Putin respond to that? So I think there's all sorts of dynamics that could yet still unfold from this. And yeah. Agree, we got to watch it carefully.
I know that our allies, particularly the Balts, are very nervous about the military adventurism that they might find themselves on the end of such a tactic by the Russians. And they've been concerned about that from the very beginning. So, you know, how that plays out, what it looks like. I mean, it's not tanks crossing the border, but what does it look like? What does he need to do to use that kind of tactic to shore up his, you know, the unity there in Russia? Is going to be interesting because it won't be what we think it would be. It could be something else.
That's right. And just look at the, you know, recently what we haven't talked about yet is an assassination attempt against the mayor of Prague, or at least an alleged assassination attempt using a suitcase full of ricin by an accredited Russian diplomat. I mean, this takes the Skripal case and blows it up to a whole nother level. So yes, the Russians are still behaving very aggressively, and it's very hard to predict what they're going to do next, but it doesn't, you know, it's not going to be pretty, I don't think, what we see coming out of Russia over the next 3, 6, 9 months.
Well, this has been a fantastic conversation. We covered an incredible amount of ground. We did domestic Russia, we did Russia-China, we did Russia-Europe, we've done US-Russia. So I would say we did our due diligence, we did our job in kind of commemorating and marking this 20th anniversary of Putin's inauguration. Mike, thanks for joining us. It's been a fantastic conversation, as I said. Thanks for taking the time, and we hope we get to do it again, maybe even as we get a bit closer to the election this fall.
Great to see
you, Mike. Fantastic. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye, guys.
Bye.